Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and practiced on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. High Truths is more than a podcast. It's a movement to unite physical, mental, and addiction health. It brings innovations to connect public health, public safety, and prevention. Our discussions inspire people to implement programs that save lives. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a 5-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com. Today's episode is sponsored by Drug Free America Foundation, tackling the pervasive issue of substance use and its far-reaching impacts on individuals, families, and community. Drug Free America is supporting ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis, doctors and scientists educating on the harms of marijuana. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a research conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. Research, as in the unbiased, purely scientific study of answering questions to specific problems. We have bench research that discovers new medications and pharmaceuticals and that learns about how our body functions. We have clinical trial research that tests one treatment compared to another. But my favorite research is one that evaluates the effectiveness or consequences of health policies. Does decriminalizing drugs or legalizing drugs save more lives or cost lives? What are the health outcomes of commercializing marijuana? Do people have less pain or more suicide? On this episode, I reach out to a medical and research expert who practices medicine as well as does extensive public health population-based studies. We all need to turn to this type of research when making policies that affect public health. To learn more about research that should guide health policy, I reach out to Dr. Daniel Myron. Dr. Daniel Myron is a public health and preventative medicine physician, family physician, and researcher. He holds a Canada Research Chair in Social Accountability at the University of Ottawa and is an assistant professor in the Department of Family Medicine. He practices family medicine with an interest in addiction medicine. Dr. Myron's research uses health data to track visits for mental health and substance use at the population level and leads to the best understanding of how drug policies affect public health. To learn more about Dr. Daniel Myron, check out the High Truth show notes. I recorded this conversation with Dr. Myron on June 13th, 2025. Dr. Daniel Myron, welcome to High Truths.
Thanks for having me on the podcast.
Very excited, and it took us a while to connect because of, you know, not only your busy life, but you became a new dad of three. You don't look old enough to have three children, but congratulations to you.
Yeah, thanks. I feel old enough. So
great. I told you that I thought, okay, I'm going to study up on all your research. And then it's like, you have over 100 publications. You've been so prolific and raising a family. Tell us about your path. How did you your journey to medicine and of all things to study substance use and mental health?
Sure. So I'm a public health trained physician and a family doctor. I have an interest in patient care and addiction, but a real interest in understanding what are the upstream drivers of what make people healthy or unhealthy. For me, a big piece of that has been looking at public policy and drug policy. I actually started off looking at alcohol policy at the time that I was doing my training and doing a master's of public health. The government in Canada was kind of moving forward with changing the way alcohol was sold. There was a question of whether people would drink more from that. And then shortly after, we moved ahead and legalized non-medical cannabis. And it kind of all came together to say these are very big shifts in alcohol and drug policy, and let's understand whether or not that changes how much substances people use and related health harms.
That's great. So you saw this coming and said, we need to get the research to show data on whether this is smart or not, or needs to be altered. Do you get pushback on your work?
You know, I think what's really funny about my work is everyone gets to hate it. And I think the reason why everyone gets to hate it is because people more on the left side of the political spectrum look at my comments or look at the work, which is saying, well, maybe cannabis is not as safe or as harmless as it's often portrayed. And that's viewed as, you know, alarmist, and, you know, it's not always desired from the left. And then on the right, it's a pretty anti-free market message. So it's kind of saying that cannabis and alcohol are potentially unhealthy commodities, and that this is not a place to leave an unregulated free market, and that you actually want some government intervention. So for different reasons, you know, maybe no one likes my research. So that's always fun.
I love your research. I thought it's like, I guess when you're in the middle, you're spot on. And if both sides hate you, then you're under, you know, that's probably the truth. But let's dive into it. I thought that we have time. We could talk about drugs in general, cannabis, psychedelics, and alcohol. So first of all, what is your research, I think, was in British Columbia in Canada, and the move was to decriminalize drugs and not legalize drugs. Where are we, so we could see, you could tell us what the health consequences have been?
Sure. So, I mean, we've done a couple of studies. I think that we recently published a study about drug decriminalization in British Columbia. So in British Columbia, which is, you know, a province in Canada, the government moved forward with decriminalizing the personal possession of a small amount of opioids, cocaine and derivatives, MDMA. And the idea being is that you wanted to avoid police encounters and criminal justice harms for people in possession of a small amount of drugs. And we did an evaluation saying, well, does this first reduce the number of police encounters that people have for drug possession? And then next, do you see changes in hospitalizations and deaths related to opioids and stimulants? And what we saw is that the policy is remarkably effective at reducing police encounters. So you see very rapid declines in the number of people who are being arrested by the police for simple drug possession. You actually don't see changes for drug trafficking, which is not part of the policy. That's for people who have kind of a larger amount of drugs and are probably planning on selling it. And then you also don't see changes in drug possession offenses in the rest of Canada, who does not decriminalize personal drug possession. But you see no change whatsoever, no increase or decrease in hospitalizations or deaths for opioids and stimulants. And what we kind of talked about was saying that, you know, there's real reasons, and I think this theme comes up in cannabis too, there are real reasons to rethink an approach where you arrest and charge people for minor drug possession. And I think that there's massive societal and public health benefits that can come from that. And in the case of drug decriminalization, it doesn't seem to be a major driver of kind of overdoses and some of the more severe outcomes. And I think that for people who are hoping that this would be, you know, a quick fix, the opioid epidemic and the drug epidemics in North America have revealed that there is no quick fixes, and that there's no, you know, silver bullet, and that this is a wicked policy problem that needs lots of different measures to come to bear.
Right. Now, that's decriminalization, different than legalization, right? And are drugs legal anywhere in Canada?
Well, so for legalization, you know, Canada has moved through, you know, a national change with cannabis. So, for example, you know, Canada had medical cannabis that was available in very limited forms starting in the early 2000s. And the government was actually the authorizer of medical cannabis. And then medical cannabis gets liberalized again nationally through a court challenge in 2014. And then you have basically anyone any provider can authorize medical cannabis if they say the patient has a condition that will benefit from it. And then we moved forward with legalizing non-medical cannabis in 2018. So that's cannabis for adult use, and you set it up so that there is a commercial sale of it. So it's either in some provinces, it's the government is acting as the seller of cannabis, and in other regions, you have private industry that's selling cannabis. And the market then rapidly takes off, expanding into new products, lots of stores. And you can have debates and arguments about how much promotion and marketing there is and whether that's a good amount or not
so
enough.
As soon as you legalized, it instantly became commercialized as well.
Yeah, so Canada is the only country that has created a commercial market. So, you know, so for example, Germany has legalized cannabis, but opted not to create a commercial market. And here, when a commercial market is, you know, you're going to have brick and mortar stores that are selling cannabis. You have some degree of marketing and promotion. And you're actually, you've said not only will this product be legal for possession and use, but we're actually going to create a system in which people, adult consumers can purchase a variety of different products.
Interesting. Now, when we're talking, I just want to clarify, the legalization is just for cannabis. It's not for fentanyl and cocaine and other things.
Yeah. So other drugs remain. So for example, in British Columbia, we were talking about it. You've decriminalized personal possession of drugs, but you have not legalized them, and you have not created commercial markets for them. So you can't, you know, there is no store that you can walk into and say, I'm here to purchase, some cocaine, or I'm here to purchase some fentanyl.
Interesting. And because the consequences of that would be different based on your research.
Yeah, I think that when I think about drug policy, I think that, you know, you have prohibition on one side. And along with that, there are, you know, there are social consequences and health consequences that occur from that. You can have, you know, you can, in the middle, you might have the decriminalization or legalization of the substance with very tight regulations and public health oriented controls. And then you can move over to a commercial market with a lighter touch regulation. And in many places, you might think of the way alcohol is sold as kind of a commercial market with lighter touch regulation. It depends on, you know, the state that you're in or the country that you're in. But in general, alcohol causes enormous health and social harms in society, and that it is not priced the way it should be for the harms that it causes. The marketing that we have for it is probably much more ubiquitous than you would want for an unhealthy substance like that. And our general approach to regulating it is less than most people in public health think should be done.
The difference, I think, with alcohol and cannabis at this moment, at least, is that when you're purchasing cannabis, you can't rely on the purity of it, what other substances are in, whether the toxins are in there, what it says on the label, if it's true. But with alcohol in general, correct me if I'm wrong, there's probably not going to be methanol. You're probably not going to go blind in it. There is some type of, universal global standard that when you buy alcohol, that it doesn't have all these other bad products like it did back in the prohibition bootlegging days.
Yeah, like I mean, I think that we have, alcohol, the harms that arise from alcohol are not because of adulterants or other impurities or things that are there. I mean, alcohol causes harm by virtue of the substance, but it's absolutely true that, you know, when you are buying alcohol, the label is accurate, you're getting exactly what's there, it's predictable. With cannabis in Canada, one of the arguments in favor of legalization was that you would provide adult consumers with a regulated supply of something that was inspected, that you generally had a sense of the psychoactive content of the product, and that it had been through a variety, you know, that there wasn't going to be mold in it, and you would know if there had been pesticides, and, you know, there isn't going to be something else right in the product. And I think that, you know, Canada has had some trouble with, the THC dosing has not always been accurate, and there's been various recalls of products, but in general, I think legalization has succeeded in that regard, in that you now can walk into a store and you can say, I am looking for a product with this quantity of THC, and it will be dried flower, whatever it is that you're looking for, and you will get that product. Now, it's not the case, just because you know what's in it doesn't mean that the product is safe, and it doesn't mean that there aren't health
harms. But I'm wondering, even that basis, is that true? I don't think that's true in the United States. I think if you've gone to a legal dispensary, 100% mm-hmm. of the flower has mold or some type of bacteria in it. Or the testing that's done is going to certain labs that are not testing for everything, and there's still a whole bunch of adulterants.
Yeah, I'm not super familiar with the US and what's available, and I would imagine that it would probably vary state by state because of the different policies and what's going on. I mean, I think that you could say that an advantage of and I view this as true, an advantage of creating a legal market is that you have better ability for inspection and regulation of what's in the product.
Yeah. Interesting. All right. So now let's dive into the what you just said. Just because it's legal doesn't mean it's safe. So now since legalization, and then here you've got hundreds of publications on this. And some of them were, I think, ones we really have to take pause, like what you published on mortality, more chances of you just being dead after going to the emergency department or hospital for a cannabis associated illness. Tell us about that.
So yeah, we've done a couple of studies. Most of these will be in Ontario, which is the most populous province in Canada. So it's around 14.5 million people. And because we have a universal health system, it covers 97% of the people living in Ontario. And we have data where you can track people over time. So I know, the data set knows your demographic information and it knows your healthcare encounters, and you can follow people backwards and forwards. And we've done a series of studies where we say, well, what happens to people who come to the emergency room or the hospital and they have a cannabis code? So in the view of the treating health team, cannabis was either the main reason they were in the emergency room or hospitalized, or a significant contributing reason. And we've looked at a variety of health harms. And so we've looked at whether or not you're at higher risk of a new anxiety disorder diagnosis, whether you're at increased risk of being diagnosed with schizophrenia, whether or not you're increased risk of death and different types of causes of death. And we've looked at dementia diagnoses too. And I would say across all of them, we see that people who are in eMERGE or hospitalized for cannabis use are at increased risk of either a new diagnosis of that condition or mortality. And I would put a couple of really important caveats on that. And again, they apply universally. And one of them is that there's undoubtedly confounding that goes into these studies. So for example, someone who's in the emergency room for cannabis use and they have an increased risk of death compared to someone in the general population of the same age and sex, and even controlling for other mental health comorbidities and other chronic health conditions, which we do in the studies. So, they have the same amount of diagnosed hypertension and they have the same cardiac history and they've seen a psychiatrist before at a similar rate. And they've, been in eMERGE for opioids and alcohol in the past for a similar rate. There's still unmeasured confounding. So I think that, if you're in eMERGE for cannabis, you probably smoke more cigarettes than the person who's not in eMERGE for cannabis. And you probably use more drugs, even though we try and adjust for that. And your sociodemographics may differ. And I think part of the reason that you see these increases in risk is that these are riskier people. And that's all there. And I think it's relevant to look at. But it is also true that these are concerning associations. And when we do, mathematical techniques to say, hey, there's probably some stuff that explains part of it, it doesn't seem to explain all of it. So maybe some of the increased risk of death by cancer or death through cardiovascular disease is explained by higher rates of tobacco use, but it doesn't seem like that explains all of it.
Right. And I guess you're saying that because tobacco use is higher in Canada, which is because it's pretty low in general in the United States.
I think so tobacco use is higher in people who are in eMERGE for tobacco. So we don't know. We don't have data on tobacco use, for example. You get to study, you study millions of people for everyone in Ontario and you have their healthcare visits, but no one has reported their tobacco use in the health records that you have. So the person who's in eMERGE with a cannabis use disorder, where they're having health and social problems because they can't stop using cannabis, they probably smoke cigarettes and more of them. They're more likely to smoke cigarettes like tobacco. Yeah. Than they are to smoke than someone who wasn't in eMERGE for cannabis. So right. that's the source of bias or confounding that's there.
Yeah. And eMERGE, you mean emergency department?
The emergency department. Yeah. And, similarly, we see a study where the risk of dementia You know, we looked at a cohort of people who are 45 and older, and we found that a middle-aged or older adult who's in the emergency room for a cannabis reason, within 5 years, has a 72% higher risk of being diagnosed with dementia than someone who wasn't in the emergency room. And compared to everyone who's in the emergency room. So, this person was here for cannabis, and we're comparing them to someone who's there for a non-cannabis reason. So they were there for, a heart attack or an asthma attack or a cut.
That makes sense biologically. Like you're telling us that data epidemiologically, but I think biologically also it makes sense as far as where cannabis affects the brain. And if you just think about how people behave when they're on cannabis, like their speech, their thought process. You know, one of the things that for drug driving is that you can't follow like a simple three-step command, kind of like a dementia diagnosis. So that makes sense.
Yeah, we were talking about how, like, again, it depends on the condition, but like for dementia, we were saying, look, there's probably, and again, none of these studies like should be looked at in isolation. Like all of our stuff is part of larger bodies of evidence, and people have done brain imaging study and memory tests, and you find a pretty consistent pattern that cannabis is not changes the volume of brain of the brain in places associated with dementia, or people perform worse on memory function. But I think that you have, like, for dementia, cannabis is probably directly, and regular cannabis use is probably directly changing brain structure and maybe changing memory and cognition. It might also be increasing other risk factors for dementia. So, cannabis seems to have cardiovascular impacts, and there's emerging evidence that THC itself may do that. So it might increase your blood pressure. It may change the way the inflammation in your blood vessels. So it could be doing two things. It could be directly changing your brain, and it may also be setting you up to have a higher risk of stroke or heart attacks and other stuff that also lead to health problems.
Yeah. Well, I mean, makes sense, right? I think that while the brain is number one target for THC, we're showing that the heart is the number two target. And I think that the research is pretty big on the association with heart disease and stroke. And so I think the dementia part makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the other part that I think is really not as much in the public awareness as it should be, even though it's one of the most researched areas, is the link with psychosis and schizophrenia. And again, we've done studies finding that, people who are in eMERGE for cannabis related problems or cannabis induced psychosis, which is when someone consumes cannabis and temporarily will have, hallucinations or intense paranoia. These folks are at very, very high risk of being diagnosed with schizophrenia. We did a study of everyone in Ontario, and we found that amongst people in their teens and early 20s, men, if you have a male who's in their teens or early 20s and they're in eMERGE for an episode of cannabis-induced psychosis, 40% of them will have a new diagnosis of schizophrenia within 3 years. And when we've looked at changes in schizophrenia after legalization and the proportion that's seems to be related to cannabis use, that's rising as well. So we see that an increasing number of new diagnoses of schizophrenia seem to be related to heavy cannabis use over time, and that there's some markers of psychosis that have actually gone up at the population level. So there's just more and more cases of people coming and being diagnosed with certain types of psychotic disorders.
Yeah, I think that's, we've kind of research-wise proved it, kind of like we've proved that tobacco is a causation effect with heart disease and lung cancer. I think we've proven that THC is a causation of a psychosis and schizophrenia. Not everybody who smokes is going to get lung cancer. Not everybody who uses cannabis is going to have schizophrenia or psychosis, but it's definitely a risk factor.
Yeah. And my view would be, I think that when you look at the collective evidence, that there's really strong support for a potential causal role between THC and schizophrenia. I think the debate is less, does this cause schizophrenia, but how much, what proportion? Like, and again, I think that
It's state-related, amount-related, potency-related, right?
Yeah, and like, you know, is this something where it turns out that 5% of cases of schizophrenia were, you know, attributable to cannabis and wouldn't have occurred if it hadn't been there, or is it higher, is it lower? And those are really important things to figure out. But it does, you know, given, you know, I find the data out of the U.S. that the number of people who use cannabis daily has overtaken the number of people who drink alcohol daily, should give immense pause to what is happening, especially since the potency of the product has really increased over time as well.
Right. And sadly, in the United States, we're not able to measure the public health effects like you are, because we don't have a socialized system. We don't have everything in a nice little database that you're able to tap into.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in some ways, there's one of the real advantages is because of the high quality healthcare data that we have. Canada has been able to create a lot of natural experiments, so differences in policies that can then be evaluated. And we've done studies showing that, you know, we found that there were very large increases in cannabis poisonings in young children after legalization. So these are kids who are admitted to hospital in you know, they're between the age of 0 and 9. And they're quite ill. These are kids who, you know, needed. They were having seizures. They had stopped breathing. They needed oxygen. Like very, very sick kids. And we found that after legalization, they increased substantially across the country by around sevenfold. But that the provinces that allowed the sale of legal edible products, so these are cannabis infused candies and desserts and gummies and all those different products, they see double or more than double the increase in poisonings as the one province who said, we're not going to let any of those come to market. So in the province of Quebec, they were worried about the appeal for youth and the potential for youth poisoning. And like, you know, they allow dried figs that are infused with cannabis, but, or, you know, broccoli. So things that, you know, children are not going to get into and consume. And the other provinces, which allow, you know, essentially stuff that's indistinguishable from candy and dessert once it's out of its packaging, they see double the increase in these poisonings.
We tried in California to pass a bill. We were unsuccessful in prohibiting candies, marijuana candies that appeal to children. And we showed all that data of pediatric poisoning. And it failed. Would you be in favor of such a thing?
Yeah, I think that one of the really interesting things that happened in Canada when we legalized cannabis is we made the blanket judgment that any product offered on the illicit market should be offered on the legal market in order to compete with the illicit market. And I think that there are products that are on the illicit market that should not be sold legally. I think that adult consumers have a whole different variety of ways to consume cannabis, and that there's actually very little societal gain and benefit of selling cannabis-infused candies, and that they come with risks like child poisonings, inadvertent adult ingestions. And again, I people then go, oh, well, the illicit market's gonna, you know, sell those products, and I go, let them. I think that the police enforcement costs of immediately and completely eliminating the illicit market are enormous. I don't want to live in a society in which you have completely, you know, the day after legalization, the illicit market has completely gone away, because I think that the type of enforcement activities to do that would be substantial and are not a great idea. So I think that you can allow a small amount of illicit market activity to continue for products that you think come with too much risk. And that sticks around, and that there's just some products that you say this shouldn't be offered on the legal market. And, you know, again, Quebec, the province who is not selling, you know, legal cannabis edibles, is doing just fine. They're, you know, they have a well-working legal market. Adults have lots of options for different products, and they have fewer poisonings. I don't see it as that you necessarily have to offer these types of products.
Yeah. That makes sense. You mentioned there's a lot of work on psychosis and schizophrenia, but you also did work on anxiety. And a lot of people who use, if you ask them, like, okay, I use marijuana either recreationally or even they say it's medically, it's I need it for my anxiety. And when I hear people tell me that, I feel like they're treating their withdrawal symptoms because they're addicted. And the withdrawal symptom of cannabis use disorder is anxiety. So were you able to differentiate that and actually show that you have more anxiety associated with cannabis use?
Yeah, we found that people who, again, in eMERGE for a cannabis-related cause, they are at increased risk of being diagnosed with a new anxiety disorder, and they are at increased risk of having an existing anxiety disorder that previously was only being managed in an outpatient setting, of ending up being hospitalized or an eMERGE with a new or worsening anxiety problem. So in our studies, it seems that it increases your risk of developing anxiety disorders and it worsens your existing anxiety disorders. And that's compared to people who aren't in eMERGE for cannabis.
And yet the public doesn't see that, doesn't know that, a very important thing. They feel like it helps anxiety and it's sold as something to help with your anxiety.
Yeah. And I'm not in the business, and like, again, in practice, I'm not in the business of telling people, you know, someone's in clinic and they're like, I use cannabis for my anxiety and I feel that my anxiety is much better. I'm not there to invalidate that experience. Mm-hmm. And it could be that there is some group of individuals who, you know, feel that they really benefit from it. I think on average, it will probably end up being not good for anxiety. And there's data to support that. And I think it's hard to tease out the idea that there's definitely a group of people who experience anti-anxiety properties of acutely using cannabis. There's some people who get terrible panic attacks as well. So it's not that everyone sees an improvement in their anxiety, but there are some people who really do seem to have a temporary benefit for anxiety. But in the long run, and I, again, this is my clinical experience, that many of these people are numbing symptoms of anxiety, but that the cause of their anxiety is not going away, and their resiliency and their coping skills for dealing with anxiety are going down. Because often with anxiety, when you avoid something, when you avoid triggers, when you avoid things that create it, you actually diminish your capacity to deal with anxiety. And, you know, most like cognitive behavioral therapy, when you have your approach to dealing with anxiety, the approach is to have, you know, gradual increasing exposure to anxiety and work on kind of coping skills that allow you to deal with that and to proceed.
Yeah. But do you see the people who are, you know, actively using and they feel like it helps their anxiety, but they're really compensating for covering their withdrawal?
Sure. I think that
cigarettes,
there's...
Right? People say, oh, cigarettes are helping me, my anxiety. And maybe at the beginning it was true, but, you know, several pack years later, they're really, it's their addiction.
Yeah, I think that there's certainly people who, you know, will have that the cannabis moves from being something that was having, you know, a certain effect to its ongoing use is to avoid a resurgence in anxiety symptoms or to avoid withdrawal symptoms. Or, you know, in the case you have people who have very severe cyclical vomiting and nausea from regular cannabis use. So it's certainly the case that there's many people who are developing either a psychological or a physical dependence on cannabis. And especially as the product has dramatically changed, the THC content of cannabis being sold on the legal market in Canada today, like the dried cannabis flower, is mostly 20 to 30% THC. And that's compared to, you know, it would have been 4% in the early 2000s. And, you know, in the 70s, it would have been 1 or 2%.
Very different product. PTSD. People are really pushing, I guess, the business of marijuana to help, you know, veterans with PTSD. They should have cannabis. Government should pay for their cannabis to treat mm-hmm. their PTSD. But what does the science say?
I've done less research on that. It's, again, from the types of data access that we have, it's a harder study to do. So I wouldn't, you know, I have less, I have less capacity to talk about what we've done here. We did a study looking at people coming to eMERGE with PTSD and whether or not they were also had like a co-diagnosis of a cannabis use problem. And we found that the proportion of people with PTSD visits who have problematic cannabis use has really risen over time in Canada. you know, it's there's not great evidence from other people's studies about the efficacy of cannabis for PTSD, but I haven't personally done any research on it. But having, you know, having read the general body of of literature, there's not a strong supporting body of evidence for it.
And yet we see the evidence that it's causing problems in that subgroup.
Yeah. So for people who have PTSD and a cannabis use disorder, the comorbidity of those would make it much harder to treat, in the same way that someone with PTSD and alcohol use disorder is going to have a tougher disease treatment and chance of recovery.
Right. And then before we get off on the cannabis, I do want to have some time to talk about the psilocybins, but suicide, where we're seeing that association in young people.
So the literature is certainly there, that there seems to be an increased risk of suicide and self-harm for people with cannabis. And we have a study that we're looking at that right now.
Yeah. And psilocybin, is that legal, not legal in Canada? I know you've done it, but tell us about your research on that.
Yeah. So psilocybin, there's really interesting parallels and really interesting differences with psilocybin and cannabis. But right now in Canada, psilocybin is available through clinical trials, and it's available through, you can have a healthcare provider can apply to the government through a special access program, where you say, I have a patient, they have, they're suffering, and I would like to apply to get them psilocybin for the mental health condition that they have. But there is not, it has not been legalized for non-medical use. What's really interesting is that, similar to what happened in Canada for non-medical cannabis use in the lead up to legalization, is happening with psilocybin, and that you have this proliferation of gray market stores. So right now, we did a study looking at kind of stores that were selling psilocybin and their presence across the country, and kind of the health claims they were making. And we found that there's around 70, at the time we did the study, there was around 70 stores across the country. They're mostly in large urban cities, and they're selling psilocybin, and it's illegal. These are not legal stores, but that they operate kind of in a gray zone where the police are not necessarily enforcing it, or an agreement has been made. If for American listeners, like if you pop by a city like Toronto or Ottawa, or Vancouver, you will see, you may be surprised, but you will see.
It's in all the smoke shops.
You'll see stores selling magic mushroom stores.
Yeah. Everywhere. They have posters on it. But what are the health consequences that you're running into?
So we looked at a study looking at people. It's going to sound like a broken record here, but we did a study of people in the emergency room for a hallucinogen related visit, and we found that they were at increased risk of both death and schizophrenia, new schizophrenia diagnoses. And again, the hallucinogens, the coding for it, it's quite broad. So it's capturing, the psychedelic drugs, but it's also capturing dissociative hallucinogens like ketamine. My ability to say magic mushrooms really increases, occasional use of magic mushrooms really increases your risk of death or schizophrenia. We have no notion. That's not what we studied. What we found was, is people who are really having, a mental health crisis that's precipitated by a hallucinogen use, or, a major problem related to hallucinogens, a very bad experience with it, they're at pretty elevated risk of death and schizophrenia.
And the risk of death is by, trauma, like jumping off a bridge and doing something like that?
Or the largest one was through self-harm, through suicide. So there was a signal of suicide. There was a very small signal of trauma, and then a lot for other drug overdoses. And again, that speaks to, I don't look at someone who's in a merge and they were there for a hallucinogen and they're dying of an opioid overdose 3 years later. I don't think that was the hallucinogen that did that. I think it's a high-risk population who's using a lot of opioids as well.
What you said, you started your research on alcohol, and I probably see a lot of correlations in alcohol. What What has happened to alcohol sales since legalization? Is there an association? I know there's probably a market competition, right? Like alcohol.
So people, you know, one of the big arguments for legalization that's offered is that, you know, through a drug substitution mechanism, that people will use less opioids and less alcohol, and that because cannabis, you know, and again, like alcohol is very harmful. Alcohol is the, you know, the leading of like it, you know, alcohol causes more deaths than opioids.
Yeah.
And it causes more societal harm. So just because a substance is legal and regulated doesn't mean that it doesn't cause problems. But the hope was, is that people will drink less alcohol because they'll be using cannabis, or they'll reduce their opioid use because they're using cannabis. The literature is really low quality and mixed on this topic. There is a lot of small survey-based designs where people will say, yes, I started using cannabis instead of opioids, or I started using cannabis instead of alcohol. To me, like the high quality studies where you say, has there been any change in the volume of alcohol that's being sold, have shown no effect. Or if there is an effect, it's so small that it's not that meaningful from a public health perspective. So we did a series of studies where we said, has the volume of alcohol in Canada changed after cannabis was legalized? And we found that when you looked at all types of alcohol, there was no effect. A previous team had found this effect where they said canned beer sales were, you know, declining, but not bottled beer sales were declining. And they said it's legalization. And it turns out it's just coolers got really popular at the same time. So people stopped drinking canned beer and started drinking, pre-mixed spirits. But there's really no, in Canada at least, there's been no meaningful effect of legalization on the amount that we're drinking.
Yeah. And with alcohol, there are dietary guidelines to alcohol, right? Like 7 drinks a week for men, 14 for women. I think Europe changed it to just 7 for men and women. What are your thoughts on those dietary guidelines? I think you wrote something about we should look at DALY.
So Canada is old and everyone has a different standard drink. So it's always confusing. So like a standard drink in Canada is not actually the same amount of alcohol as a standard drink elsewhere. But Canada's former drinking guidelines were for 14 drinks and 7 drinks, but it's been revised down. So what the new evidence was is that there's increasing data that alcohol causes cancer, that there's no safe level of alcohol consumption for cancer, you know, and so any amount of alcohol consumption is causing some increase in your risk of cancer. And that much of the evidence in previous guidelines about the benefits of alcohol for cardiovascular disease were overestimated for a variety of biases. So the new Canadian guidance divides alcohol into different levels of risk, but essentially says there is no safe level of alcohol consumption. Now, how much you drink and how much additional risk of harm you take on is depends on your risk tolerance. So, you know, it's kind of said that, you know, less than 7 drinks a week of standard drinks is coming with a moderate level of risk. But what not everyone agrees on what a moderate level of risk is. So I, for you know, and the messaging is really nuanced and challenging. And different people would make different choices because we all have different personal risk tolerances. But I think the message that we were hoping to convey is that no one should be drinking alcohol because they think it's good for their heart health, and that you should be accepting of the idea that any level of alcohol consumption is associated with an increased risk of adverse events, including cancer. But it doesn't mean that if you're having 3 drinks a week, that you're actually at a very elevated risk and that you're likely to experience an alcohol-related harm.
I think alkaloid-related harm, such as, you know, you said, you know, cancer or liver disease or other problems like that. But what about just alcohol use disorder and at-risk drinking, right? So in general, we say, like, if you're having more than 4 drinks at a time, you're an at-risk drinker.
Yeah, so like heavy episodic drinking where, you know, you're having like four or five standard drinks on a drinking occasion certainly increases your risk, or binge drinking would be like, you know, most people would be more familiar with that. Increases your risk of a whole variety of, you know, problems like, you know, of falls and trauma and stuff like that. In addition to, you know, when you drink, certainly when you drink larger amounts, it spikes your blood pressure and you can have, you know, cardiovascular events and things like that.
Yeah, important. So with all this, again, robust literature, you're continuously producing. What's next on your horizon? What are you interested in? What are you looking at?
I think that we're really interested in some longer term evaluations of what happens for with legalization. So, you know, we've got pretty good data of the first like 3-4 years after legalization, which overlaps quite heavily with the COVID-19 pandemic and teasing out what was COVID. You know, you see a lot of increase in cannabis use and harms, and what was COVID and what was legalization and what was a unique mixture of the two is less clear. So understanding some of the longer term impacts to me are really interesting. I think that continuing to monitor changes in hallucinogen use are fascinating. There's been, you know, psychedelics, magic mushrooms, all of these things are becoming increasingly popular. And we didn't chat about it, but with, you know, there are differences because there's a lot of drug trials coming out saying that psychedelic assisted therapy may have benefits for certain conditions. And there's a popular sense that this is, you know, may have of efficacy for a variety of mental health conditions.
Your magic answer, using magic mushrooms.
And you know, we it's a different
conversation. Forget the FDA trials, you know.
Yeah, different. It's a different conversation, but it is, it's, you know, again, and I, you know, how much skepticism one should have, and, you know, the quality of the evidence is a worthy discussion, but there will end up being more and better evidence for psychedelic assisted therapy for some mental health conditions than cannabis for some mental health conditions. And it's, so I think it's really interesting to continue to observe.
But that should be done through a pharmacy, right? Not through Amazon.
Yeah. So again, my view, and when I talk about the policy implications of this, is I say right now in North America, I think that we're mixing two different policy questions. There's a policy question about, is psychedelic assisted therapy a promising new intervention that should be rigorously evaluated and dispensed through a medical system where you have healthcare providers who are, you know, picking a dose and providing therapy and monitoring for adverse effects? And should we ensure that there is a pathway for that? And should we legalize non-medical use or recreational use of psychedelics and hallucinogens? And those are distinct questions, but we're lumping them together. And I think that we often, you know, it's often part of like the same conversation. And I think that you do an injustice to both of those ideas. If you want to legalize or decriminalize psychedelics for non-medical use, and you have a rationale for that, that is a different argument than if you're saying we think this is really good for people's. We think this should be, you know, one of several evidence-based therapies for people with PTSD. And yeah. you don't want to conflate those two arguments.
I like how you say that. Thank you. All right. And as a new dad, last question. This is just amazing. What do you say? What do you tell your children? You have boys, girls. What do you tell them? What are you going to tell them when they're old enough to actually listen? You got a little.
Yeah, my kids are much too young for conversations about drugs and substance use. I mean, oh yeah, it's what a strange world they're gonna enter, and it's very hard to tell.
But your influence as a parent is number one.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think that
tell their children, I don't want you using drugs, are more likely not to use drugs.
I think conversations will be for all substances about the absolute importance of delaying. Right. That, so, you know, whether what people choose to do in their lives is ultimately up to them. I think that there will be messages about, you know, all of the reasons to be concerned about it. And that, you know, if people are choosing to use substances, you know, and I hope, I like personally would not, I would be I would not like my, you know, kids in their teens to be using drugs.
The studies have shown that if you tell your children, I don't want you, be clear about it. I don't want you drugs. Chances are they won't, because they love you. They want to do what you say. If you're wishy-washy about it, they'll be wishy-washy about it.
Well, I think that the strongest thing that I want to emphasize is that there really should be nothing before your brain is done maturing, which is around for boys in your mid-20s. And the evidence is really good for that for cannabis too, that some of the risks, psychosis,
protect
and addiction.
Your brain. Protect your brain.
Yeah. So people should be protecting their brains, and that we've missed that conversation too in Canada. We set a minimum legal age of 18, 19, or 21, depending where you are. And that kind of people make the assumption that, oh, I'm 19, it's legal, it's safe. And, you know, in reality, maybe you shouldn't be using it till your mid-20s if you're going to.
That's great. Dr. Danielle Myron, thank you so much for this conversation, for your research, and lots of health to your whole family.
Okay, well, thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Drug Free America Foundation. Visit DFAF.org and ISAIC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis. That's IASIC1.org. High Truth's producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.